Her citation for unlawful assembly costs Mimi $300. It's not a bad deal. She has paid twice as much for a winter coat that gave her half the satisfaction. Word of her arrest gets out at work, but her superiors are engineers. If she can deliver her team's molding projects on time, the company doesn't care if she works from a federal prison. When 1,000 marchers descend with placards on the Department of Forestry headquarters in Salem, demanding reform of the timber harvest plan approval process, Mimi and Douglas join them. Early one April Saturday, the pair drive to an action in the Coast Range. Douglas takes a vacation day from the hardware store where he has found work. The morning is beyond beautiful, and as they head south, listening to grunge and the day's headlines, the sky cools from dusky rose to cerulean. A rucksack in the back seat contains two pairs of cheap swimming goggles, T-shirts to wrap around their noses and mouths, and modified water bottles. Also, his and hers steel double-lock police-grade handcuffs, chains, and a couple of bicycle U-locks. There's an arms race on. The protesters begin to think they might even be able to outspend the police, who are funded by a public convinced that all taxes are theft, but giving away public timber is not. They turn down the spur road to the protest site. Douglas scans the parked vehicles. No television trucks, not one. Mimi curses. Okay, nobody panic. I'm sure the print journalists are here, with photographers. No TV, might as well never have happened. It's early yet. They could still be on their way. A shout rises down the road, the sound of a crowd after a field goal. Through the trees, opposing armies square off in each other's faces. There's shouting, a bit of scrum, then a scuffled tug-of-war with someone's jacket. The latecomers trade glances and break into a trot. They reach the face-off in a clearing in the denuded woods. It's like some Italian circus. A double ring of protesters surrounds a track-mounted Cat C7-powered monster whose crane arches above their heads like a long-necked dinosaur. Fellers and Buckers circle the anarchy. A special fury hangs in the air, the product of how far this wooded hillside is from the nearest town. Mimi and Doug trot up the incline. At the roar of a chainsaw, she tugs his arm. One snarling machine sets off another. Soon a chorus of gas-powered rippers screams through the woods. The loggers swing their machines lazily, laconically. Reapers with scythes. Douglas stops.
Are they fucking nuts?
It's theater. No one's going to chainsaw an unarmed human being. But as Mimi speaks the words, the driver of a loader with two women handcuffed to it kicks his rig into gear and drags them alongside. The protesters scream in disbelief. The loggers turn their attention from the hostage cat. They set to work on a stand of grand fir, threatening to drop the trees into the midst of the handcuffed slackers. Doug mutters and tears free. Before Mimi can react, he's running toward the unraveling action, rucksack in tow. He wades into the fray like a setter into the surf, dashing among the protesters, gripping one man, then another, by the shoulder. He points at the handfellers descending on the firs.
Get as many people as we can up into those trees!
Someone shouts, Where the hell are the police? They're always here to break things up when we're winning.
Okay, Douglas barks. Those trees are going to be history in 10 minutes. Move!
Before Mimi can reach him, he springs off, heading for a fir with a skirt of branches low enough to hop up into. Once he's off the ground, the limbs are practically a ladder 80 feet straight up. 2 dozen flagging protesters revive and take off after him. The loggers see what's happening on their flanks. They pursue as fast as their nail-soled caulks allow. The first few protesters reach the stand and scramble up into the foliage. Mimi spots a fir with branches even she can reach. She's 20 feet from the trunk when something vicious clips her legs. She falls headlong into a patch of devil's club. Her shoulder hits a lichen-covered stone and bounces. Something heavy camps on the back of her calves. Douglas, from 30 feet up his tree, shrieks at the assailant,
"I'll kill you, so help me God, I'll tear your head from your cretin neck!"
The man sitting on the back of Mimi's knees drawls,
"You're gonna have to come down for that, aren't you?"
Mimi spits mud from her mouth. Her assailant grinds his shins into the back of her thighs. She yells, despite herself. Doug scrambles down a branch.
"No!" she shouts. "Stay!"
A few tackled demonstrators lie on the ground, but some reach the trees and swing up into the branches. There they keep their pursuers at bay. Shoes win out over reaching fingers. Mimi moans,
"Get off me!"
The logger who pins her wavers. His side is outnumbered, and he's tied down, restraining an Asian woman too small to climb anything bigger than a shrub.
"Promise to stay down."
The civility stuns her.
"If your company kept your promises, this wouldn't be happening."
"Promise."
Nothing but flimsy oaths, binding every living thing. She promises. The logger springs up and rejoins his stymied side. The loggers huddle up, trying to salvage the situation. They can't cut the furs without killing someone. Mimi spies Douglas in his tree. She has seen that tree before. It takes her too long to recognize. The tree in the background behind the third arhat in her father's scroll. The loggers start up their saws again. They wave them in simplifying swipes through the air, cutting scrub, stacking it in fall zones in front of the firs. One of the fellers makes an undercut in a big tree. Mimi watches, too stupefied to cry out. They mean to bring it down through the branches of a squatter's tree. The great fir cracks, and Mimi screams. She shuts her eyes to a tremendous crash. She opens them on downed timber tearing through the grove. The squatter clings to his mast, moaning in terror. Douglas rains abuse down on the cutters.
"Have you lost your damn minds? You could kill him!"
The crew boss shouts,
"You're trespassing!"
The fellers prepare a new fall zone. Someone produces bolt cutters and starts clipping through the handcuffs of the cat-chained protesters, like he's pruning a dogwood. Scuffles break out across the clearing. The luxury of non-violence is over. In the fir grove, a feller tips his saw into the butter of the next doomed fir, aiming to drop it 3 feet from another squatter's tree. The target squatter's screams are lost over the saws, lost to the loggers with their padded earmuffs. But they see his arms waving like mad and hold up just long enough for the terrified Mark to scramble to the ground. It's a full-out rout on both fronts. The blockaded vehicles begin to roll. 9 of the remaining squatters drop from their roosts. The loggers, triumphant, swing their saws. Protesters fall back, like deer from a fire. Mimi sits on the spot where she made her promise. The air behind her whoops. She turns to see flashing lights and thinks, the cavalry. 20 officers in full armor disgorge from an armored truck. Black polycarbonate helmets with wraparound face guards, Kevlar jackets, projectile-proof, high-impact riot shields. Police sweep across the clearing, rounding up the trespassers, snapping bracelets on the wrists even of those who already sport one severed cuff. Mimi rises. A hand comes down hard on her shoulder, pushing her back to the ground. She swings around to face a cop, scared and all of 20 years old.
"Sit down, and don't move."
"I wasn't going anywhere."
"Mouth off again and you'll regret it."
3 Saturday Forest warriors jog past, back toward the road and their cars.
The child cop yells, "Stop where you are and sit down! Now, now, now!"
They flinch, turn, and sit in place. Nearby loggers cheer. The kid cop spins and sprints toward another group of protesters trying to get away. A squad fans out under the trees. Pairs of them stand under the last treed protesters, smacking at their feet with nightsticks. The five remaining squatters give up. All except Douglas Pavlicek, who climbs higher. He takes his own cuffs from the rucksack and seals one wrist. Then he reaches around the trunk and locks the second wrist into place. Mimi grabs her head.
"Douglas! Come down! It's over!"
"Can't!"
He rattles his cuffs, locked in the hug of the trunk.
"Have to hold out until TV gets here."
The crazed holdout kicks at the logging ladders that the police position into the fir. He scores one fend-off so athletically that even the loggers cheer. But soon enough, four policemen swarm his lower regions. Chained in place, Douglas can't move. The police reach their bolt cutters up to sever his cuffs. He pulls in his arms, snugging the chain against the trunk. The loggers hand axes up to the police, but Douglas laces his fingers in front of the chain. The police can reach no higher than his waist. A quick consult, and they cut into his pants with industrial shears. Two cops secure his legs. The third slices the ragged denim up to Douglas's crotch. Mimi stares. She has never seen Douglas's bare thighs. She has wondered these months whether she ever might. His desire is as open as the look of wonder on his face when they share a cold fudge shake. The only secret is what has kept him from anything more calamitous than putting his hand on the back of her neck. Weeks ago, she concluded it was some war wound. Now she watches him get stripped in public, in front of a stunned crowd. One leg is open to the air, bony and blanched, almost hairless, the furrowed thighs of a much older man. Then the other leg, and now the jeans hang open from the waist like a shredded banner. Out comes a triple-action pepper spray. Capsaicin, mixed with CS gas. The onlookers call out,
"He's chained in place, man! He can't move! What do you want from him?"
The officer puts the canister up into Douglas's groin and sprays. Liquid fire spreads across his cock and balls, a cocktail amounting to a few million Scoville heat units. Douglas hangs, dangling from the cuffs, breathing in short little aspirated gasps.
Shit! For God's sake, he can't move! Leave him alone!
Mimi twists to see who yelled. It's a logger, short and bearded, like an enraged dwarf from the pages of Grimm.
"Unlock yourself," one of the police orders.
Words clog Douglas's mouth. Nothing comes out but a low pitch, like the first half-second of an air raid. They spray him again. Protesters who've sat in place peacefully waiting to be booked start to revolt. Mimi rises in a rage. She's shouting things she won't remember even an hour from now. Others around her stand up, too. They converge on the prisoner's tree. Police prod them back. The officers in the tree hit the naked groin with one more canister of spray. The soft, droned pitch in Douglas's mouth begins a slow, awful rise.
"Unlock your hands and you can come down. It's easy."
He tries to say something. Someone below shouts,
"Let him talk, you animals!"
The police lean in close enough to hear him whisper,
"I dropped the key."
The police cut Douglas free and carry him down from the tree like Jesus from the cross. They won't let Mimi anywhere near him. When the ordeal of their processing is done, she drives him home. She tries to wash him with every soothing emollient she can find. But his meat is a vibrant salmon, and he's too ashamed to let her see.
I'll be fine.
He lies in bed, reading the words off the ceiling.
I'll be fine.
She checks in every evening. His skin stays orange for a week. Mastery 2 rakes in as much as the annual income of whole states. Mastery 3 arrives just as its ancestor starts to grow stale. People from 6 continents pour into the upgraded place, frontiersmen, pilgrims, farmers, miners, warriors, priests. They form guilds and consortiums. They build buildings and fashion trade goods that the coders never anticipated. Mastery 4 is 3D. It turns into a monumental undertaking, almost breaking the company, needing twice as many coders and artists as its parent. It offers 4 times the resolution, 10 times more game area, and a dozen more quests. 36 new techs, 6 new resources, 3 new cultures, more New World wonders and masterworks than a person could explore in years of play. Even with the constant doubling of processor speeds, it pushes the limits of the best consumer rigs for months. Everything unfolds as Nile foresaw it years ago. Browsers appear, yet another nail in the coffin of time and space. A click, and you're at CERN. Another, and you're listening to underground music from Santa Cruz. One more, and you can read a newspaper at MIT. 50 big servers at the start of year 2, and 500 by the end. Sites, search engines, gateways. The spent, filled-up cities of the industrialized planet have willed this thing into being just in time. The savior of the gospel of endless growth. The web goes from unimaginable to indispensable, weaving the world together in 18 months. Mastery gets on board, goes online, and a million more lonely boys emigrate to the new and improved Neverland. The homesteading days are over. Games grow up. They join the ranks of the globe's elite commodities. Mastery 5 surpasses whole operating systems for sheer complexity and total lines of code. The game's best AIs are smarter than last year's interplanetary probes. Play becomes the engine of human growth. But none of that does much for Nile in his apartment above the company's HQ. The room teems with screens and modems blinking like Christmas. His electronics range from matchbook-sized modules to rack mounts larger than a man. Each one of these devices is, as the prophet says, indistinguishable from magic. The wildest sci-fi of Nile's childhood failed to predict these miracles. And still, impatience doubles in him with every doubling of specs. He hungers worse than ever for one more breakthrough, the next one, something simple and elegant that will change everything again. He visits his oracle trees in their Martian botanical garden to ask them what's supposed to happen next. But the creatures stay mum. Bed sores plague him. His increasingly brittle bones make going outside dangerous. 2 months ago, he smashed a foot getting into the van, the hazard of not being able to feel where your limbs end. His arms are bruised black from whacking them on the bed bar getting in and out of bed. He has taken to eating, working, and sleeping in the chair. What he wants more than anything, what he'd trade the company for, is a chance to sit by a lake in the high Sierras, 10 miles down a trail, and watch crossbills sweep up into the branches of the bordering spruces to pry seeds out of the cones with their grotesque beaks. He'll never have that. Never. The only outing allowed him now is Mastery 6. In Mastery 6, a player's colonies go on thriving while he's away. Dynamic, concurrent economies. Cities full of actual people trading and making laws. creation in all its extravagant waste. People pay monthly rent to live there. It's a daring step, but in the world game, no daring is fatal. The only thing that will kill you is failing to leap. Nile can no longer tell the difference between calm and desperate. He sits by the picture window for hours at a pop, then dashes off epic memos to the development team, nagging about the same thing he has pushed for years. We need more realism, more life. The animals should start and stop, saunter and stare, just like they're living models. I want to see the way a wolf rocks back on its haunches, the green of their eyes as if lit from inside. I want to see a bear rake open an anthill with his claws. Let's build this place up in every detail, from stuff out there. Real savannas, real temperate forests, real wetlands. The Van Eyck brothers painted 75 different kinds of identifiable plant species into the Ghent altarpiece. I want to be able to count 750 kinds of simulated plants in Mastery 7, each with its own behaviors. As he composes the memo, employees knock and enter, with papers for him to sign, disputes for him to resolve. They show no revulsion or pity for the giant walking stick propped upright in the chair. They're used to him, these young cybernauts. They don't even notice the catheter anymore, where it empties into its reservoir on the chair's frame. They know his net worth. Semper Virens Common closed that afternoon at 41.25, triple last year's IPO. The twig man in the chair owns 23% of the company. He has made them all wealthy, and he has made himself as rich as the game's greatest emperors. He dispatches the latest pamphlet-sized memo, and moments later, the shadow comes over him. Then he does what he always does whenever the bottom drops out. He phones his parents. His mother picks up.
Oh, Nile! So happy it's you.
So happy too, Moti. You good?
And it doesn't matter what she's saying. Pita taking too many naps, planning a trip back to Ahmedabad. Ladybug invasion of the garage, very strong smelling. Might be cutting hair very dramatically soon. He revels in whatever she wants to go on about. Life. In all the pitiful details that won't fit yet into any simulation. But then, the killing question, and so soon this time.
Nile, we are thinking again that it's not impossible to find you someone in the community.
They have been all up, down, around, and over this for years. It would be socially enforced sadism toward any woman brought into such a match.
No, Moti, we've said.
But, Nile.
He can hear in the way that she pronounces the words.
You're worth millions, tens of millions, maybe more. You won't even tell your mother. What sacrifice there? Who couldn't learn to love?
Mom? I should have told you already. There's a woman here. She's actually one of my caregivers.
It sounds almost plausible. The hush on the other end crushes him with its tongue-biting hope. He needs a safe and reassuring name, one he'll remember.
Rupi. Rutu. Her name's Rupal.
A horrible suck of breath, and she's crying.
Oh, Nile! So happy.
Me too, Mom.
You will know true joy. When do we meet her?
He wonders why his criminal mind failed to foresee this little difficulty.
Soon. I don't want to scare her away.
Your own family is going to scare her? What kind of girl is this?
Maybe next month? Late next month?
Thinking, of course, that the world will end long before then. Already feeling his mother's bottomless grief at his simulated breakup, just days before the women were to meet. But he has made her happy in the only place where people really live,
the few-second-wide window of now. It's all good. And by the time the call ends, he's promising people in both Gujarat and Rajasthan at least 14 months' notice to clear calendars, buy airplane tickets, and get saris made prior to any wedding.
Goodness! These things take time, Neely!
When they hang up, he raises his hand in the air and slams it down onto the desk's front edge. There's a very wrong sound, and a sharp white pain, and he knows he has broken at least one bone. In blinding pain, he rides his private elevator down into the opulent lobby, the beautiful redwood trim paid for by millions of people's desire to live anywhere else but here. His eyes stream with tears and rage, but quietly, politely, to the terrified receptionist, he holds up his swollen, snapped claw and says, "I'm going to have to get to the hospital." He knows what's waiting for him there. After they mend his hand, they will scold him. They'll put him on a drip and make him swear to eat properly. As the receptionist makes her frantic calls, Nile glances up at the wall where he has hung those words of Borges, still the guiding principle of his young life. Every man should be capable of all ideas, and I believe in the future he shall be. Portland sounds toxic to Patricia. Expert educating witness, even worse. Dr. Westerford lies in bed on the morning of the preliminary hearing, feeling like she's had a stroke.
Can't do it, then.
Can't not, babe.
Do you mean that morally or legally?
It's your life's work. You can't walk away now.
It's not my life's work. My life's work is listening to trees.
No, that's your life's play. The work part is telling people what they're saying.
An injunction to halt logging on sensitive federal land. That's a question for lawyers. What do I know about the law?
They want to know what you know about trees.
Expert witness? I'm going to be ill.
Just tell them what you know.
That's the problem. I don't know anything.
It'll be just like stepping in front of a class.
Except instead of idealistic 20-year-olds who want to learn things, it'll be a bunch of lawyers fighting over millions of dollars.
Not dollars, Patty. The other thing. And yes, she admits, hauling her feet out onto the cold floorboards, this one is about the other thing, the very opposite of dollars, the thing that needs all the testifiers it can get. Dennis drives her the 100 miles in his decaying truck. Her ears are throbbing by the time they reach the courthouse. During her preliminary statement, her childhood speech defect flowers forth like a great May magnolia. The judge keeps asking her to repeat. Patricia struggles to hear every question, and yet she tells them. The mystery of trees. The words rise in her like sap after winter. There are no individuals in a forest. Each trunk depends on others. She fights off personal hunch and keeps to what the scientific community agrees on. But, as she testifies, science itself starts to seem as flighty as a high school popularity contest. Unfortunately, the opposing counsel agrees. He produces the letter to the editors of the journal where her first major scholarly article appeared, the one signed by 3 leading dendrologists crushing her into the earth. Flawed methods, problematic statistics. Patricia Westerford displays an almost embarrassing misunderstanding of the units of natural selection. Every part of her flushes with blood. She wants to vanish, to never have been, to have folded some poisoned mushrooms into the omelet she made herself this morning, before Dennis drove her to this tribunal.
Everything in that paper has been confirmed by later research.
She doesn't see the trap until it's sprung.
You overthrew existing beliefs, the opposing counsel says. Can you guarantee that further research won't overthrow yours?
She can't. Science, too, has its seasons. But that's a point too subtle for any court of law. Watching, the watching of many, will converge on something repeatable, despite the needs and fears of any one watcher. But she can't swear to the court that the science of forestry has finally converged on new forestry, that set of beliefs she and her friends have helped to promote. She can't even swear that forestry is really a science yet. The judge asks Patricia if it's true what the expert witness for the opposition has earlier claimed, that a young, managed, fast-growing, consistent stand is better than an old, anarchic forest. The judge reminds her of someone. Long car trips through newly plowed fields.
If you carved your name 4 feet high in the bark of a beech tree, how high would it be after half a century?
That's what my teachers believed 20 years ago.
Is 20 years a long time in these matters?
It's nothing for a tree.
All the warring humans in the courtroom laugh. But for people, relentless, ingenious, hard-working people, 20 years is time enough to kill whole ecosystems. Deforestation, a bigger changer of climate than all of transportation put together. Twice as much carbon in the falling forests than in all the atmosphere. But that's for another trial.
The judge asks, young, straight, faster-growing trees aren't better than older, rotting trees?
Better for us, not for the forest. In fact, young, managed, homogeneous stands can't really be called forests.
The words are a dam break as she speaks them. They leave her happy to be alive, alive to study life. She feels grateful for no reason at all, except in remembering all that she has been able to discover about other things. She can't tell the judge, but she loves them. Those intricate, reciprocal nations of tied-together life that she has listened to all life long. She loves her own species, too, sneaky and self-serving, trapped in blinkered bodies, blind to intelligence all around it, yet chosen by creation to know. The judge asks her to elaborate. Dennis was right. It is like talking to students. She describes how a rotting log is home to orders of magnitude more living tissue than the living tree.
I sometimes wonder whether a tree's real task on earth isn't to bulk itself up in preparation to lying dead on the forest floor for a long time.
The judge asks what living things might need a dead tree.
Name your family, your order. Birds, mammals, other plants, tens of thousands of invertebrates, 3/4 of the region's amphibians need them. Almost all the reptiles, animals that keep down the pests that kill other trees. A dead tree is an infinite hotel. She tells him about the ambrosia beetle. The alcohol of rotting wood summons it. It moves into the log and excavates. Through its tunnel systems, it plants bits of fungus that it brought in with it on a special formation on its head. The fungus eats the wood. The beetle eats the fungus.
Beetles are farming the log?
They farm, without subsidies, unless you count the log.
And those species that depend on rotting logs and snags, are any of them endangered?
She tells him. Everything depends on everything else. There's a kind of vole that needs old forest. It eats mushrooms that grow on rotting logs and excretes spores somewhere else. No rotting logs,
No mushrooms. No mushrooms, no vole. No vole, no spreading fungus. No spreading fungus, no new trees.
Do you believe we can save these species by keeping fragments of older forest intact?
She thinks before answering.
No, not fragments. Large forests live and breathe. They develop complex behaviors. Small fragments aren't as resilient or as rich. The pieces must be large for large creatures to live in them.
The opposing counsel asks whether preserving slightly larger forest tracts is worth the millions of dollars it costs people. The judge asks for numbers. The opposition sums up the opportunity loss, the crippling expense of not cutting down trees. The judge asks Dr. Westerford to respond. She frowns.
Rot adds value to a forest. The forests here are the richest collections of biomass anywhere. Streams in old growth have 5 to 10 times more fish. People could make more money harvesting mushrooms and fish and other edibles year after year than they do by clear-cutting every half dozen decades.
Really? Or is that a metaphor?
We have the numbers.
Then why doesn't the market respond?
Because ecosystems tend toward diversity and markets do the opposite. But she's smart enough not to say this. Never attack the local gods.
I'm not an economist or a psychologist.
The opposing counsel declares that clear-cutting saves forests. If people don't harvest, millions of acres will blow down or burn in devastating crown fires.
It's out of her field, but Patricia can't let it go.
Clear cuts increase wind throw. And crown fires only happen when fires are suppressed for too long.
She lays it out. Fire regenerates. There are cones, serotonous, that can't open without flame. Lodgepole pines hold on to theirs for decades, waiting for a fire to spring them.
Fire suppression used to seem like rational management, but it costs us much more than it has saved.
The counsel for her side winces, but she's in too deep for diplomacy now.
I've looked at your book, the judge says. I never imagined. Trees summon animals and make them do things? They remember? They feed and take care of each other?
In the dark-paneled courtroom, her words come out of hiding. Love for trees pours out of her. The grace of them, their supple experimentation, the constant variety and surprise. These slow, deliberate creatures, with their elaborate vocabularies, each distinctive, shaping each other, breeding birds, sinking carbon, purifying water, filtering poisons from the ground, stabilizing the microclimate. Join enough living things together, through the air and underground, and you wind up with something that has intention. Forest, a threatened creature. The judge frowns.
What grows back after a clear cut isn't a forest?
Frustration boils over in her.
You can replace forests with plantations. You can also arrange Beethoven's 9th for solo kazoo.
Everyone laughs but the judge.
A suburban backyard has more diversity than a tree farm.
How much untouched forest is left?
Not much.
Less than a quarter of what we started with?
Oh, heavens! Much less. Probably no more than 2 or 3%. Maybe a square 50 miles on each side.
What's left of her vow of circumspection blows away.
There were 4 great forests on this continent. Each was supposed to last forever. Each went down in decades. We barely had time to romanticize. These trees out here are our last stands, and they're disappearing. 100 football fields a day. This state has seen rivers of log jam 6 miles long. If you want to maximize the net present value of a forest for its current owners and deliver the most wood in the shortest time, then yes, cut the old growth and plant straight road replacement plantations, which you'll be able to harvest a few more times. But if you want next century's soil, if you want pure water, if you want variety and health, if you want stabilizers and services we can't even measure, then be patient and let the forest give slowly.
When she finishes, she falls back into blushing silence, but the counsel pressing for the injunction is beaming. The judge says,
"Would you say that old forests know things that plantations don't?"
She squints and sees her father. The voice is wrong, but there are the rimless glasses, the high, surprised eyebrows, the constant curiosity. All those first lessons from half a century ago cloud around her. Days in the beaten-up Packard, her mobile classroom, tooling around the back roads of Southwest Ohio. It stuns her to recognize all her own adult convictions there in embryo, formed by a casual few words with the window rolled down on a Friday afternoon and the soy fields of Highland County unspooling into the rearview mirror. Remember?
People aren't the apex species they think they are.
Other creatures, bigger, smaller, slower, faster, older, younger, more powerful, call the shots, make the air, and eat sunlight. Without them, nothing. But the judge wasn't in that car. The judge is another man. It could be the eternal project of mankind to learn what forests have figured out. The judge chews on her statement, the way her father used to chew on sassafras, those root beer-scented twigs that stay green all winter. They return after recess for the decision. The judge places a stay on the contested cut. He also issues an injunction on all new timber sales of public land in western Oregon until the impact of clear cuts on endangered species is assessed. People come up to Patty and congratulate her, but she can't hear. Her ears shut down the moment the gavel hits the desk. She leaves the courtroom in a bank of fog. Dennis is by her side, leading her down the hall and out onto the plaza, where two crowds of demonstrators face off in a gauntlet of banners on each side of her.
"You can't clear-cut your way to heaven. This state supports timber. Timber supports this state."
Enemies shout at each other across the gap, stoked by triumph and humiliation. Decent people loving the land in irreconcilable ways. They sound to Patricia like quarreling birds. A tap on her right shoulder, and she turns to face the opposing expert witness.
"You've just made lumber a whole lot more expensive."
She blinks at the accusation, unable to see how that might be a bad thing.
"Every timber firm with private land or existing rights is going to cut as fast as they can."
Their hands freeze and their legs stiffen up, in space too cramped to turn over in. Nights are harsh enough to frostbite their sap-covered toes. The constant wind and flapping tarps shred their attempts to talk. Sometimes fat branches crash down from above. The quiet can be even more unnerving. Climbing is all the exercise they get, but in the changing light and floating days, things that would have seemed impossible on the ground become routine. Mornings are a game of cat and mouse, or, say, owl and vole, with watchman and maidenhair peering down from their damp, freezing airy onto the tiny mammals scurrying on the floor far below. The crews show up before the fog diffuses. One day, there are only 3. The next, 20, loud in the cockpits of their machines. Sometimes the loggers wheedle, "Come down for 10 minutes.
"Can't right now. We're busy tree-sitting."
"We have to scream. Can't even see you. This is breaking our necks. Come on up. Lots of room up here."
It's an impasse. Different men show up on different days trying to break it. Crew boss, foreman. They yell hoarse threats and reasonable promises. Even the vice president for forest products pays a visit. He stands underneath Mimas in a white hard hat, like he's orating on the floor of the Senate.
"We can send you to prison for 3 years for criminal trespass."
"That's why we're not coming down."
"The losses we are incurring, huge fines."
"This tree is worth it."
The next day, the white-hatted VP is back.
"If you two come down by 5 p.m. this evening, we'll drop all charges. If you don't, we can't guarantee what'll happen to you. Come down. We'll let you walk. Your records will be clean."
Maidenhair leans out over the edge of the grand ballroom.
"We're not worried about our records. We're worried about yours."
The next morning, she's debating one of the loggers again when he stops in mid-sentence.
"Hey, take your cap off for a second."
She does. His shock is obvious from 2/3 of a football field away.
"Shit! You're gorgeous!"
"You should see me up close, when I'm not frozen and have taken a bath in the last month or two."
"The hell you doing sitting up in a tree? You could have any guy you want."
"Who wants guys when you can have Mimas?"
"Mimas?"
It's a small victory just getting him to use the name. Watchman releases a salvo of paper bombs onto the loggers below. Unfolded, the sheets reveal pencil sketches of life at 200 feet. The loggers are impressed.
"You drew these?"
"Guilty."
"For real? You got huckleberries up there?"
"Thickets."
"And a pool with little fish in it?"
"There's more." Days pass, wet and icy, each more miserable than the last. The sitters that were to relieve Watchman and Maidenhair never show. The standoff enters week 2, and the ring of workers at the foot of Mimas turns angry.
"You're out in the middle of nowhere, 4 miles from the nearest person. Things could happen. Nobody would know."
Maidenhair beams down on them, beatific.
"You guys are too decent. You can't even make a credible threat."
"You're killing our livelihood."
"Your bosses are doing that."
"Bullshit."
1/3 of forest jobs lost to machines in the last 15 years. More trees cut, fewer people working.
Stumped, the loggers wander into other tactics.
"For Christ's sake, it's a crop. It grows back. Have you seen the forests south of here?" "It's a one-time jackpot,"
Watchman shouts down.
1,000 years before the systems are back in place." "What's the matter with you two? Why do you hate people?"
"What are you talking about? We're doing this for people."
"These trees are going to die and fall over. They should be harvested while they're ripe, not wasted."
"Great. Let's grind up your grandfather for dinner while he still has some meat on him."
"You're insane. Why are we even talking to you?"
"We have to learn to love this place. We need to become natives."
One of the loggers revs up his chainsaw and whacks the branches of one of Mimas's largest basal sprouts. He steps back and looks up, brandishing a limb like a sailboat mast.
"We feed people. What do you do?
They shout at Maidenhair, tag team.
We know these forests. We respect these trees. These trees have killed our friends.
Maidenhair holds still. The idea of a tree killing a person is too much for her to think about. The men below press their advantage.
You can't stop growth. People need wood.
Watchman has seen the numbers. Hundreds of board feet of timber, half a ton of paper and cardboard per person per year.
We need to get smarter about what we need. I need to feed my kids. How about you?
Watchman sets to shout some things he knows he'll regret. Maidenhair's hand on his arm stops him. She's gazing downward, trying to hear these men, attacked for doing what they've been asked to do, for doing something dangerous and vital that they've learned to do so well.
We're not saying don't cut anything.
She dangles her arm, reaching out to the men from 200 feet away.
We're saying cut it like it's a gift, not like you've earned it. Nobody likes to take more gift than they need. And this tree would be a gift so big, it would be like Jesus coming down and...
She trickles off on a thought that Watchman has at the same moment. Been there, felled that, too.